Welcome to It's a Good Life, the podcast for entrepreneurs, where it's all about growing yourself and your business. Here's your host, founder of America's largest business coaching company, Brian Buffini.
Well, top of the morning to you and welcome to It's a Good Life. Many times I'll say I have a special guest today on a program, but today I am a little more excited than normal. When I came across this gentleman's information, had a chance to dive into his book, dive into his work, dive into his story. I'm not going to hype him too much, but in a world that specializes in being unauthentic these days, the authenticity of this man's story, his experience, and what he's doing is just fantastic. His name is Scott Harrison, and he has quite the story. He's the CEO of Charity Water, and we'll talk about that today. It's quite a journey. He was a nightclub guy and living hard, fast life. Had a change in life, a change in experience, and now he's a guy that is changing the world by bringing the most needed commodity to people in the world, which is clean water. He has a book we're going to talk about called Thirst, which is a story of redemption, compassion, and a mission to bring clean water to the world. I believe we'll all find a little bit of something for ourselves in this chat today. So, Scott, thanks for taking the time. We really appreciate you being with us here today.
All right, Brian, it's good to be here. I hope I can live up to that intro.
Yeah, well, I think it speaks for itself. Let's dive right in because you have a heck of a story. And I think people can connect, as we all know, to someone else's journey. A very, very odd journey you took, but maybe you can start off. And you know, I've heard about where you started as a kid and how you ended up in New York City, and maybe you can just share a little bit of your background.
Well, yeah. So when I was 4 years old, my mother collapsed on the floor. Unconscious on New Year's Day in 1980. And this was kind of a really remarkable event in my life. What happened was she had been poisoned by carbon monoxide. And she was the proverbial canary in the coal mine. We had just bought a new house a couple months previous. My dad and I had started getting these weird headaches and these health symptoms. And then mom goes down. And her trip to the hospital reveals high levels of carbon monoxide in her bloodstream, which then leads to the discovery of the actual gas leak in our house. And I was an only child, really kind of Christian, really devout parents. And everything changed in that one moment. My mom became an invalid for the rest of her life. And what happened, Brian, is her body shut down, her immune system's ability to process anything chemical from that point on just ended. And she wore a mask, a version of, you know, the COVID N95 mask for the rest of her life. She lived in isolation. Anything chemical in the world would make her sick, whether it was soap, whether it was car fumes. I remember as a boy, the ink from books would make her sick. So I would have to bake mom's books in the oven, you know, for days on kind of warm, right? Like 200 degrees to try to get the smell of print out. And then if she wore her mask and if she wore special gloves and she put this baked book into a cellophane bag, then she could read. So it was a weird childhood. My parents had aspirations of a big family like yours, but they ended with one kid, me. And I really went into a caregiver role at a very young age. So I was helping mom with the cooking and the cleaning and kind of partnering with my dad to take care of a very sick woman. And, you know, I was raised in the church. I would play piano on Sundays. If you asked me what I wanted to do when I was a teenager, I would have said, I'm going to be a doctor so I can cure my mother and I can cure all the other sick people like her. I didn't smoke. I didn't drink. I didn't have sex. I didn't swear. You know, I didn't look at porn. I was just that really good kid that was raised, you know, in this kind of community.
With a heavy burden on him.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't realize that at the time. You know, I thought my childhood was just my childhood. You know, you don't really know what you missed out on. So that was kind of chapter one of my life. At 18, I wake up one day and just say, look, now I want to have some fun. The church is not fun. Rules are not fun. Being a doctor, 8 years of medical school, that doesn't sound like fun. You know what sounds like fun? Moving to New York City and becoming a nightclub promoter. That sounds like fun. So, you know, really, to the horror of my parents, I, instead of following this path, instead of accepting a college scholarship, I join a rock band. I grow my hair down on my shoulders, and I start promoting nightclubs in New York City, and picking up all of the vices that you might imagine would come with that territory. You know, it starts with smoking, and then it was the drinking, and then it was the drugs, and then it was the gambling, and then it was the pornography, and, you know, just kind of one by one, all of those things I said I would never do just became a part of my life and a part of this lifestyle. And I think in some ways, you know, having the chance to write the book and maybe reflect back, I was trying to make up for a lost childhood. I was trying to overcompensate. And also I thought religion was no fun. There was no freedom. There was no joy. You know, this was rules based. This was all the things that you couldn't do. And I wanted to do those things. So I spent 10 years, I guess chapter two of my life, becoming a
night- In the wilderness.
In the wilderness. But Brian, it looked pretty good, bro. I was running 40 different nightclubs over that time. So it was a world, as we used to joke, of models and bottles. So, you know, you get the most beautiful, successful, famous people pass the velvet rope into the club, and then you could charge $25 for a cocktail that cost 25 cents. You could charge $1,000 for a bottle of Cristal champagne that cost you $100, and you could make people buy five just to sit down at a table. So kind of, you know, climbed to the top of New York City's social ladder. There were probably eight of us, eight different entities running all of nightlife in a city of 9 million people. And I thought I was fantastic and fabulous. I dated girls that were on the cover of fashion magazines. I drove a BMW. I had a Rolex watch. I had a grand piano in my New York City apartment. I flew private on other people's planes to Buzios, Brazil, and Punta del Este, Uruguay, and to Paris and Milan and London Fashion Week. And, you know, really what was happening to my soul was it was getting sicker and sicker. And this pursuit of a selfish, hedonistic, sycophantic life led me really to such a great despair 10 years later. Slowly and then suddenly, where I just realized one day at 28 years old, my gosh, I've become the worst person I know. I mean, I don't know anyone more shallow, more vapid, more emotionally bankrupt, more spiritually bankrupt, more morally bankrupt. This will be relevant later, but I remember throwing at a party at my nightclub once where I attached a charity to the revenue of the nightclub that night. And I said, I will give a percentage of the proceeds to a charity. And I don't think I even gave 1%.
Oh, wow.
I marketed the charity to give them less than 1% of what we made. At 28 years old, you know, one day, inexplicably to me, maybe not to a listener now, half my body just goes numb. And I can't feel half of my body. I remember walking across my loft, putting my my arm under boiling hot water. I could see the steam rising, and I couldn't feel the hot water on my arm. And I was convinced something was deeply wrong with me. Maybe I had a brain tumor. Maybe I had an incurable disease. And I just remember such a moment of clarity being faced with what felt like instant mortality. What if I did die in the next few days, in the next week, in the next month? What was my life all about? How would I be remembered? What would be written on my tombstone? And the only thing I could come up with, Brian, was here lies a man who's gotten 1 million people wasted and made some money doing it. And I just realized how far I had come from, you know, the foundation of faith and spirituality and intention and compassion that my parents had tried to instill in their only child. And you know, maybe like the prodigal son story, you know, I found myself just in the pig pen covered in feces, even though that pig pen looked kind of great on the outside. And I wanted to go home. I wanted to find my way back home. And, you know, I wound up getting the EKGs and the MRIs and the CT scans, and the doctors couldn't find any tumor. They couldn't find anything wrong with me. The thing wrong with me was probably this lifestyle. Two packs a day of cigarettes, cocaine, ecstasy, MDMA, you know, you name it, whatever I could get my hands on. Taking Ambien to go to sleep at noon after, you know, being up all night. So the symptoms kind of just slowly dissipated over time. But I remember just saying, I want my life to look exactly the opposite. You know, what would the 180 degree opposite look like? You know, I know in business, we talk a lot about pivots. You know, a pivot was not what was needed. This was not a small course correction that was called for. This is like, just figure out everything you've done for 10 years and then think the exact opposite, do the exact opposite, say the exact opposite, and see where that goes. And, you know, I kind of remembered this concept back in my childhood faith of tithing, the idea of, you know, you give 10% of your money to the church or to charity. And I remember kind of deal making with God and saying, look, I will give 1 year. I will tithe time. I've wasted 10 years. Let me give you 1 year and let me see if I can be useful to people in need. And it was a very simple idea. It was, could I volunteer for 1 year on a humanitarian mission? And could any of those skills that I picked up, you know, running 40 nightclubs for 10 years be useful to people who were suffering, to people in need? And then I applied to 10 organizations that I'd heard of, the famous charities of the world, and I was denied by all 10 organizations. But, you know, I really believe God had a plan, because the 11th said, if you are willing to pay us $500 a month, you can volunteer. Oh, and by the way,
you gotta pay me to volunteer.
I got to pay them. And I also had to go live in the poorest country in the world at that time, which is a country I'd never even heard of. It was post-war Liberia, West Africa. And I just remember kind of joking to God. I'm like, well, I asked for opposite. I mean, what could be more opposite than selling, you know, models to, you know, Jay-Z and Puff Daddy and Jim Carrey and the Rolling Stones, you know, this kind of fashion elite in New York City? What could be more opposite than paying to volunteer in the poorest country in the world? And I said yes, and that really started the third chapter of my life, and that moment was 19 years ago. So third chapter is now longer than chapters one and two. But I found this opportunity to volunteer on a medical mission and to embed with a group of humanitarian doctors and surgeons on a huge hospital ship that sailed up and down the coast of Africa, bringing high-quality, free medical care to people in need. And I remember the day before I walked up the gangway of the ship, the day before I surrendered my passport, kind of in international waters, to become a crew member of this mission, I quit everything the night before. I remember smoking my last cigarette and, you know, doing my very last drug and you know, looking at my last pornographic image. And I just wanted I wanted everything to be different in the most extreme kind of all in, you know, cold turkey way. And I wanted to start a new life. And that led me to post-war Liberia.
Wow. I mean, that's enough, right? We got the movie. You know, if it was a Netflix show, that'd be the cliffhanger, right? I was like, what in the world? So I'm really interested in chapter three, because I know it involves a stint with the Mercy ships and some of the stories that came down. Why don't you talk a little bit about phase three and what happened, Mercy ships and Liberia?
Okay, so imagine a cruise liner, but instead of people on a cruise, it's filled with doctors and surgeons and nurses, and this hospital ship sailing up and down the coast of Africa for 25 years. So that's kind of the moment where I sign on. Quarter of a century of history. So before the ship would come into a port, a small advance team would post these flyers. I would joke, it's almost like promoting a new nightclub. You know, hey, the club is opening on this day, you know, be there. So it would say our doctors will be arriving on this day to triage and to screen people. And here is what we specialize in. Now, I wasn't really prepared for this, but we specialized in massive facial tumors, cleft lips and cleft palates, flesh-eating disease, and facial reconstruction. As it turned out, many people had been burned by rebel soldiers who would pour hot oil on their faces or bodies to contort them, to disfigure them during this 14-year civil war that had just ended. So I remember thinking, how many people could really turn up in a country with these, you know, almost edge conditions? And I learned that the government had given us the soccer stadium, the football stadium, in the middle of the city, the capital city, to screen the patients. And I remember vividly, like it was yesterday, waking up at 5 a.m, putting on my hospital scrubs alongside the doctors and the nurses, grabbing my 2 Nikon D1X digital cameras, and jumping in this convoy of Land Rovers as we snaked from the ship's port to this stadium in the center. And I knew we had 1,500 available surgery slots. And I remember thinking, like, is it possible that 1,500 people will turn up at 6 a.m. with these conditions? And as we neared the stadium, I'll never forget, there were more than 5,000 people standing in the parking lot, waiting for us to open the doors and begin the triage. And I later learned, Brian, many of these people had walked more than a month with their children. They had walked from neighboring countries in the hopes of seeing a doctor who could cure them. And the screening lasted 2 days. And at the end of the second day, we sent 3,500 people who were sick home without seeing a doctor, without the hope of treatment that they had come with. And that was such a pivotal moment for me. And as you mentioned, there was a little boy, first boy that I photographed. And by the way, my job as the volunteer photojournalist was to write stories and to take pictures of everything happening. So I had to document 1,500 deformed, disfigured people for the medical library over the next 2 days. So I hung this white sheet in the stadium and I set up a tripod and I would move 1,500 people in front of the sheet and I would take their picture for this medical library. And the first boy that I remember was this 14-year-old boy named Alfred, and he was suffocating to death with this massive, pink, fleshy, volleyball-sized tumor. And his mom was smart. She'd gotten him there 4 days early, and she pulls out this photo of her son at 10, and he looks like a healthy boy. And she said, and then it started growing. And then because there was no doctor, there was no surgeon to take him to, we took him to the local witch doctor and there were spells cast and chicken blood was spread on the tumor, but none of these things worked. And 4 years later, left unchecked, this little boy was dying as his face was being overcome with this tumor. And I just, you know, remember thinking, that's why all these people have come. That's why these doctors and surgeons who could be in the Caribbean, they could be in the Maldives at the Four Seasons, and instead they have come for a month of their vacation time to offer their skills to people in need around the world. And it was deeply, deeply moving. And I got to watch Alfred's surgery, which was 8.5 hours. And then a couple weeks later, I got to take him home, minus the tumor, with a completely new face and a completely new life, because these doctors had come.
Transformational. Wow, I got the chills listening to this stuff. So here you are, you're living the depraved life and, you know, what some people think is the greatest thing in the world. You do the opposite. You have this change and then you have this experience. Where did this lead? I mean, ultimately, where did you go from there to all of a sudden, here's the charity water guy? You know, how did that happen?
Well, I finished the year. And one of the fun things, you know, Brian, was, you know, I put redemption in the subtitle of my book. The one thing I went to Africa with was 15,000 emails of the people who had partied with me for 10 years. And back then, yes, email open rates,
yeah,
were like, yeah, 100%. You know, you sent an email and people opened it. So all the people on my list went from getting invited to the Prada megastore opening in Soho of Manhattan to a few weeks later, here's Alfred and he's suffocating to death on a tumor. And then here are the doctors who are healing him. And here's Alfred going back into his village. And, you know, I was sending this to people at MTV, at Chanel, at Goldman Sachs. You know, I was sending this to the Rolling Stones, like who were on my list. And, you know, there were people who were just, I think they just were fascinated. You know, in some ways they were living vicariously through someone they had just been doing cocaine with in the previous month in some, you know, dingy lit nightclub to here's a guy with doctors. And I think I realized that the skill I had developed over 10 years boiled down to one word. I was a promoter. And I had been promoting an idea that if you got past my velvet rope, if you spent $25 on a cocktail or $1,000 on a bottle of champagne, if you sat with the pretty girls and the pretty boys and the famous people, then your life had meaning. And I got really good at telling that story over 10 years and turning that into money. And what I did for the next year was tell a very different story of redemption and compassion and mercy and people who were pouring themselves out to end the needless suffering they saw because they could, not because they had to. And I think those stories and those images and those videos moved people. And they began to send money to this organization that I was volunteering with. And I came back to New York a year later. I put an exhibition up in Chelsea, New York with about 108 of my photographs. And I invited my friends and they gave $100,000 to the organization just going through the exhibition. So I went back to Liberia for a second year. And that was when I discovered what was making so many people sick. And as I committed to get off of the ship, out of the capital city and into the rural areas to see how people were really living, I saw people drinking dirty water for the first time in my life. And I remember watching a child walk out of her home. It was a small kind of thatched hut. And she walked up to a green algae-filled swamp and she filled a bucket and she began drinking water that was putrid, that was lethal, that was toxic. Water I wouldn't give to, let alone a dog or a cat, I wouldn't give to a cow. I wouldn't give to an animal. And I realized two really important things. I learned half the country was drinking dirty water. And half the disease in the country could be tracked back to the same dirty water. And that discovery for me, you know, again, kind of altered, you know, the course of my life. And I remember going to the chief medical officer and showing him the photos of what people were drinking in these rural areas and saying, you know, Dr. Gary, no wonder there's 5,000 people standing in a parking lot waiting for us to open the doors. They're drinking green water. They're drinking brown viscous water. They're poisoning themselves because this is all that they have. And I remember he said very simply, why don't you make this your problem? Why don't you go back to New York and why don't you try to bring clean water to everybody in the world? And I was 30, right? And I was like, okay. Okay, Dr. Gary, like whatever you say. I mean, the guy had told me to jump off a bridge at that point. I might have. I mean, he was so venerated and respected. And, you know, I think the additional juxtaposition was I had been selling Voss water in nightclubs for $10 a bottle and people wouldn't even open the water. You know, you'd roll in with your posse, you'd order 10 bottles and you just let it sit there because you were drinking alcohol. So that it was really that simple. At the end of the second year of service with this group called Mercy Ships, I came back to New York and said, I'm going to start a charity that's going to try to bring clean water to everybody alive on planet Earth before I die. The charity is going to be called Charity Water. I didn't have much creativity at the time. It was like, it's a charity that gets people water.
It's kind of brilliant.
And that was 17 years ago.
And I've seen the stats. It's like one out of every 10 people in the world is drinking bad water and all the different dynamics. You know, yep. Talk forward, because there's all of a sudden now there's a bunch of entrepreneurs listening going, okay, how'd you build this? How much have you raised? And how much clean water have you brought in the last 17 years?
Well, Brian, maybe like some of the entrepreneurs listening, I mean, sometimes what you don't know really helps you.
Right.
I mean, I knew nothing about how to start a charity. I knew nothing about institutional philanthropy. You know, I'd never met somebody who worked at a foundation in my life. But I knew everyday people, and they worked at Chase Bank or Sephora, you know, or MTV or VH1. And I started telling them about my dream to bring clean water to the world. And people said, hey, that's a good idea. People should have water. But then I realized there was this massive distrust when it came to charities. And my friend said, I don't really trust charities, though. You know, they waste your money. They have huge overheads. You know, so little money that you actually give, it reaches those people who need it. And I remember just thinking, I remember looking at kind of the charitable sector with a fresh eyes, having not been exposed to it. I was a 30-year-old kid. I came back from 2 years in Africa. And I just said, where's the Apple of charities? Where's the Nike? Where's the Virgin? Where's the, you know, the Disney? Like, where are these iconic, epic, imaginative, inspiring charities? I saw a lot of shame and guilt, and I saw a lot of charities asking people to read PDFs and 100-page reports. And that really animated me. So the mission was, hey, we're going to try to bring clean water. But the vision was actually bigger. It became, could we reinvent or reimagine what a charity would look like? How it would operate, how it would be structured, how it would interact with its donors and its volunteers and its recipients. And, you know, at the time I was completely broke. I'd given all my money to Mercy Chips and the people I met. So I was actually living on a closet floor in Soho, New York City for free rent. It was a walk-in closet and I slept on a carpeted floor. So, you know, maybe not the most auspicious time to start a global charity, but I just said, what could we do that would be different? What would the model of a perfect charity look like? And the first idea I had was, well, what if I could promise anybody who would ever give to this charity that 100% of their donation would go directly to help people get clean water? That they would pay no overhead. They would pay no office rent. They would pay no flights or insurance or toner for the Epson copy machine. What if 100% of all donations would go directly to build life-saving water projects for people in need? And I remember at the time, you know, business leaders were like, well, that's the dumbest business model I've ever heard. Like, how are you going to pay yourself someday? How are you ever going to build a team or have an office? And I said, well, I'm going to open up a separate bank account for all those costs. And we are going to operate with two separately audited bank accounts. And I'm going to raise my hand and I bet I could get entrepreneurs and business leaders to pay for those unsexy overhead costs if I can build a world-class, efficient, transparent organization. So that was a radical idea, Brian. I mean, that eliminated 99.99% of the almost 2 million charities in America just through that distinction. Then the second big pillar was just, well, what if we could use technology to track donors' money? What if I could show you, Brian, when your daughter did a lemonade stand and gave us $13.11, what if I could show your daughter where $13.11 actually went?
Brilliant. My biggest complaint of charitable organizations I'm a part of is, what did you do with it? What's the feedback? Did it help anybody?
How much of it went there?
Yeah.
And where did my... There you go. So we became the first charity in the world just simply... to put our completed projects up on Google Earth and on Google Maps. So we showed people the satellite images. So your daughter could see a satellite image of the water project in Malawi or India or Bangladesh, where her $13 of lemonade money went. And then the third kind of pillar was just this belief that for the work to be culturally appropriate, for it to be sustainable, it would have to be led by the locals in each of these countries. You know, no guy like me from New York City should run around Uganda with a hard hat on, pretending I'm a hydrogeologist and I know how to operate million-dollar drilling rigs and, you know, heavy machinery. We could build a global movement. We could get people to think about this issue for others We could engage them. We could raise money. And then if we were successful, we would create thousands of local jobs in each of these countries. And, you know, it sounds maybe simple, but three ideas: give away 100%, show people where their money goes, you know, build this network of local partners. And day one of Charity Water, the best idea I had was to throw a party in a nightclub.
This is what you knew how to do.
It's the only thing I knew how to do. And I was turning 31 and I'm like, everybody comes to a promoter's birthday party. They're always good nights. And I got the club donated and I got open bar donated. And to come to my 31st birthday party, I put out this big plexi box. You had to drop $20 in the box to enter. And at the end of the night, we collected $15,000. And I remember we counted it and we photographed it and, you know, everybody kind of audited it and signed off on it and we took it to the bank. And then all $15,000 went to build our very first well in Uganda. And then we went to see that well and we took pictures and we took video and we sent that back to the 700 people who gave $20 and said, you came to a party, you gave $20 and here is what your money did. And here are the stories of the lives impacted because you decided to give. And, you know, now that was over $900 million ago. And we just very simply took that.
So you guys have raised $900 million.
And we've done that first well now in about 136,000 communities across 29 different nations. And that's thanks to the generosity now of millions of donors from 149 countries. But it really comes down to that simple DNA of, could we just keep doing this on repeat? Use 100% of people's money, raise the overhead separately from entrepreneurs and business leaders, show people where their money goes, and then, you know, do the work in the most efficient, culturally appropriate, sustainable way possible. And we have just run, you know, an iteration of that playbook now for 17 years. And, you know, in the last 2 years, we raised $100 million in both years in donations. So this has catalyzed a lot of people to say, we will give to this. This is not our parents' charity. This is not our grandparents' charity. You know, this is something we can believe in. And then water. I mean, gosh, if we could do a whole nother podcast and talk about just what water means for humans. But at the end of the day, Republicans think this is a good idea and Democrats.
Yeah. Yes.
And people have devout faith.
I said it to the team. I said, I found a guy that it doesn't matter what your politics is. I just said it to them. Everyone can agree that everybody deserves to drink clean water.
I mean, it's true. And we have faith communities that are deeply motivated by their Christian faith. And then some of my biggest donors are agnostics and atheists and think what I do on a Sunday is the most ludicrous thing. Right. I am literally praying to an imaginary, you know, figment of my imagination, but they will give to clean water. They will give to a transparent, effective organization. So it really is a big tent. It's a unifying, you know, inarguable common good that, as you said, 700 million people right now, as we sit here in our comfortable rooms, 703 million people are drinking disgusting water. 703 million humans are poisoning themselves today because of the situations they were born into. And it's a solvable problem. There's not one person we can't help. Yeah, we're not scratching our heads saying, oh my gosh, like that one person, you know, in the northeast of Ethiopia drinking bad water. We just can't help them. We literally know how to help 100% of the people on earth get water, but we haven't chosen to do it. We haven't built the will, the determination. We haven't built the movement. We haven't raised the resources to do it. But that's what keeps me so excited 17 years in this. Like, I know how to solve the problem. If I have more money, I can help more people.
And the lesson for people listening here is, here's the journey. And like everyone on the journey, there was a lot of bumps and bruises. Those of us who have a faith see God's hands in it all the time. You know, you wanted to be a doctor to help cure your mom's sickness because that was the deep hurt in your life. You carried that hurt yourself and you became a prodigal. And then along the way, you gave yourself away. And it seems like in giving yourself away, you found yourself, found the Lord again and found, you know, now you're the guy living in the South with a wife and three kids and life is good. And here you are. But also the business model was you did what you knew. You know, success leaves clues. And even that your years in the wilderness There were things you developed. There were skills you learned. There were things you practiced based on your natural gifts, that you learned how to be a promoter and you learned how to connect, and you sold a cause, which was, you know, partying. And then you took those same principles and those same skills and brought it to this need that you saw once you got affected. You found a new purpose, you created a new vision, and then you brought something real clear to the marketplace that had 3 points. It's like, hey, we're going to give all our money away. We're going to create the secondary part outside of it, and we're going to show people where the heck that money's coming from, and then partner with people who know what the heck they're doing. And, you know, that's brilliant. That's the stuff they're not teaching at Harvard Business anymore. That's the stuff that's as good a business philosophy as any.
One last thing, just, I mean, knowing there's so many entrepreneurs listening. I mean, look, I know so many entrepreneurs, and it's all about building, and it's all about growth, and it's all about capital. And, you know, there's always someone who has more. And for 10 years, my life was driven by the insatiable desire. Somebody always had a hotter girlfriend, a better car, you know, a better loft, you know, a better plane, right? I mean, I didn't have a plane, but, you know, I've seen so many people go down this path. And I think, you know, I feel so fortunate, Brian, at 28, to have realized there would never be enough. There would never be enough. Someone would always have more. And, you know, now, you know, I just encourage people to maybe ask a different question. How can I use my time and my talent and my money in the service of others? And that could be in their local community. It could be with their family, serving their spouse, serving their kids. It could be in the global community, serving people who don't have water, who don't have food, who don't have shelter, who don't have healthcare. But, you know, I've seen a couple people, you know, make this shift, and it almost is intoxicating when you're moving from a life of accumulation, of collecting the markers of success, to then saying, well, what if my life could benefit others? You know, what if I could take everything I've been blessed with, all of the growth, all of the empire that I'm building, and if that could be useful to others? And it's you know, for me personally now, what, 17 years in, it was the most freeing thing. Or I'd still be on that, you know, that rat race. I'd still be on that treadmill.
But also the dynamic of the principle of reaping and sowing. You give it away, and the next thing you know, you didn't get money back or this thing. You got yourself back. You got your soul back. You got your family back. You got your life back. You're filled with a sense of purpose. There's no way at your age today you'd be still jacked up, fired up, pumping nightclubs and doing that, because you've probably been dead. So you gave it away and it came back.
Totally. 50% chance I'd be dead.
Yeah, right.
I would have taken the wrong thing in a dark alley.
So here it is. You give it away and it comes back. My mother used to say, give it away in slices, it comes back in loaves. We could talk all day. First of all, it's been invigorating talking to you today. We do short form podcasts. And I knew today, I'm like, hey, we are not doing a short form podcast today. He has a book called Thirst. And of course, like all things Scott Harrison, 100% of the proceeds of the book are given away to charity. And the book is brilliant. And it tells the story in detail. And I rarely promote a book, but when I do, I'm very excited about it. This one is probably my favorite book of the year I've read this year. And it's a story of redemption, compassion, and a mission to bring clean water to the world. And I promise you, you'll see yourself and your own story. It's had an impact on me to the point of my own thoughts of, you know, I've always been altruistic. Our mission in our company is to impact and improve the lives of people. Our coaching has transformed tens of thousands of people's lives. It's been a great privilege to do it. But I'm also entering into different phases of my life too. And I've been there, done that. And this has been a great time for me, Scott, to come in contact with this and really get in a picture. And I'm, you know, for me, be honest with you, I've been spending a lot of time with God saying, what needs can I help fill? And I've been filling needs in business for a long, long time, but I'm getting some peace on this myself. So I can't thank you enough for being here today. Bless you and your family. Thank you for helping 136,000 towns and spearheading that organization and being used in a way to bring water to people who never imagined. And the blessing of the prodigal son who turned around, who eventually did more than just help his mom, and has helped raise almost $1 billion to help people get water, which is the very, very essence of life. Scott, we can't thank you enough. We bless you. Anyone who's interested in finding out more about the charity, just search for Charity Water. You'll find some really cool resources there and you'll hear amazing stories. And if you're looking for a place to give and even to serve, there's opportunity there. We thank you again. You're a blessing, and we wish you nothing but the best in the years to come.
Thanks, Brian and Scott. Inspiring stuff today. We hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for the reviews you guys always leave. David Gadavari says, big fan of this podcast. It gives practical steps to help you overcome the mind games and live the good life. Cheers, David. We appreciate the kind words. As always, if we can help you or your business in any way, please visit itsagoodlife.com/BC and get yourself a free consult with one of our team here at Buffini. We're the leading business coaching company for a reason. So you'll be joining thousands of business owners in North America who've seen massive impact from having a business coach in their corner. In the meantime, here's Brian's top coach, his mum, Trace.
May the road rise up to meet you, and may the wind always be at your back. May the rain fall soft upon your fields, and the sun shine warm upon your face. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the hollow of his hand. See you next time.